Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. A shadow person story. From his childhood up until his early 20s, Peter occasionally experienced frightening sleep paralysis episodes involving a dark figure hovering over his body. He explained that because his bed was under a window, it always seemed that the figure came in like a floating thing from the window. So terrifying and disturbing were these experiences that Peter didn't wish to think about them, let alone mention them to anyone else, which he didn't. He says that even until today, he doesn't like to put his bed under windows. He would never even dream of sleeping beneath an open window. By the time that Peter was older, he had stopped experiencing sleep paralysis, and he rarely thought of the mysterious dark figure, and he was determined not to acknowledge those experiences he had had earlier in his life. Plus, he insists that he wasn't one to buy into paranormal things. Years later, though, when he was in his mid-30s, his mother related a most unusual experience. It happened when Peter was 2 or 3 years old and the family was staying at his grandparents' home in the wooded hills of South Carolina, a place they visited every summer. His mother explained that one night after she'd put him to bed, she happened to enter his room and saw, coming through the window, a black shape hovering over his body. His mother watched in shock and terror as a figure, which she perceived to be a spirit of some kind, slid out the window and disappeared. Peter added, "Before that day, she had never ever told me about this, and I never told her about my memories of this thing either. So it seemed that two different people observed the same exact manifestation without any collaboration. I don't know what to make of it all, but it is the truth. Indeed, it is a strange world that we live in, and some things, though, are best just left unexplained." A strange story about a strange encounter. In 1998, I left my home in Geelong to travel around Australia. I got as far as Townsville in Queensland, where I met up with a friend named John. He'd been living in Townsville for about 12 months. I had known John through mutual friends in Geelong, and had always found him charming and intelligent. To cut a long story short, we began living together in a relationship. For the first couple of weeks, everything was fine, as you would expect in such circumstances. Then suddenly there was a change in him that was completely unexpected and extremely unsettling. He had what I can only describe as a psychotic episode and began accusing me of being unfaithful. I should point out at the time he was smoking quite a bit of marijuana and drinking fairly heavily. That first night, he was completely irrational and scared the wits out of me. He wasn't physically violent towards me, but was very cruel emotionally and mentally. I left the bedroom where we had been arguing and went into the dark lounge room to gather my thoughts. While I was sitting on the couch, I heard a distinct laugh not far from me. I knew it wasn't John, as he was still ranting and raving in the bedroom. I then saw a tall, perhaps 7 feet, very dark shadow moving down the hall to the bedroom. Thinking that what I had heard and seen was perhaps caused by stress, I didn't give it much thought. The situation had settled down somewhat by the time I went back to the bedroom and I managed to go to sleep after a while. During the night, I woke up needing to go to the toilet and got out of bed. When I opened the bedroom door, I was confronted by a man standing in the doorway of the spare bedroom. I knew immediately that he wasn't real. I've had a few visits from my brother who died almost 20 years ago, and it always amazes me how there is no fear involved when I've seen him. But I was quite confused as to who he was and why he was standing outside our bedroom door. He was quite distinct, which was something new for me, as I usually just see shadows. He was perhaps 6 feet tall with dark hair and bad teeth. The sneer on his face is something I'll never forget. He asked me where I thought I was going. I told him I needed to go to the toilet, and he said that I had better make it quick. It seems quite ridiculous to me now that I should have had to explain myself to some unknown entity, but it didn't faze me in the slightest at the time. If anything, I was annoyed by the fact that I had to pass some weird sort of roadblock just to go to the bathroom. Anyway, this began to happen regularly. Sometimes he would appear quite distinct, at other times he would just be a dark shadow. Always, though, he would demand to know where I was going. While this was going on at night, things were getting strange during the day. John was working close to home and I was looking for a job. The thing would go to work with John and I would feel the atmosphere in the house lighten. But then just as suddenly I would feel the presence back in the house and I'd know that I was either going to get an unexpected visit or phone call from John. He would burst through the front door and start looking in all the rooms, in the wardrobes, under the beds. It was so bizarre at times that I would wonder what the hell I was doing. But at the time, I was completely isolated from my family and friends. In hindsight, I can't believe I lived like that, but I felt trapped and very confused at the time. I didn't know what the thing was. At first, I thought it was something that had attached itself to me and was trying to get rid of John. But eventually, I realized that it was the other way around. It was keeping him under its control with drugs and alcohol. I started to think of it as the monkey on his back. I would often see it in shadow form standing behind him just before we had a huge argument. When I got a full-time job, it would visit me at work, and I knew that when John came to pick me up after work, we were going to have a fight. I was turning into a nervous wreck. In 2000, we moved back to Geelong. Things didn't improve, and one day I came home from work to find the house empty. Apart from the kitchen utensils and crockery, everything else was gone, including the thing. I was upset, of course, but also relieved. I started to pick up the pieces. Eventually, John got back in touch and told me that he had gotten off the drugs and stopped drinking. We met up a few times to talk, and I was impressed by how well he looked and how I didn't see or feel the thing around him anymore. After a few months, he moved back in and things were going really well. Then one day, John came home with drugs, and the thing was back. We had a huge argument about the drugs. I was upset and crying, and I went to the bathroom to splash some cold water on my face. When I had my face down in the hand basin, I suddenly had a feeling that John was behind me with a knife in his hand. I quickly lifted my face up, and in the mirror above the basin, I saw the dark shadow behind me in the doorway. This was in broad daylight, and I ran into the lounge room where John was lying on the floor watching TV. He quickly looked around as I came into the room, and before I could say anything, he asked me where my knife was. When I asked him what he meant, he told me that he had just gotten a feeling that I was standing behind him with a knife in my hand. When I thought about it later, I realized that if the lounge room wall wasn't there, the thing had been standing directly behind both of us at that very moment. I was now very worried that someone might end up getting hurt. My brother's wife had a friend in Hopper's Crossing who was a very successful psychic, so I went to see her for some advice. I had visited her a few times socially, and my impression of her was that she wasn't easily intimidated, but the day I went to see her, she got very spooked. She described the thing to me as the most evil thing she'd ever seen. It had her rattled to the point where she cut our session short and almost pushed me out the front door. She told me that I needed someone more powerful than her to get rid of it. I have no doubt she smudged her house to within an inch of its life after I left. Not long after that, I was at work and I got a phone call from John accusing me for the 100th time of seeing someone behind his back. I felt the thing in the room with me, and after John had abused me and hung up in my ear, I told it to take him and never come back. Sure enough, I got home to find the house empty again. It was so peaceful. After 5 traumatic years, I couldn't believe how nice it was to be rid of both of them. John got in touch after a few months to tell me he was back on the straight and narrow, but I didn't even bother to meet up with him. The best part is that I've never felt the presence again. I've often wondered whether it really was an evil spirit or maybe I was seeing John's addictions in another form. I just know that I never want to go through anything like it again. The story of Helen's Bridge. A strange old bridge forms part of the remnant of an old road along the top of Beaucatcher Mountain that overlooks the town of Asheville, North Carolina. The old bridge had gotten its name from a peculiar story associated with a site. Many claim that the ghost of a woman still haunts the location to this very day. Originally, this bridge was built by the owner of a mansion in that area. The name was Zealandia, and it was owned by Mr. Philip Henry. He built the bridge in 1907 to span as a carriage bridge. But, as the story goes, regarding the ghost that haunts this bridge, it's a little bit different, and this is how it acquired the name of Helen's Bridge. Like most urban myths, there are more than one version of it. In one of it, Helen was Philip Henry's mistress, and she lived there in Zealandia. While staying with Harry at the mansion, she would often have her daughter along, who would run and play along in the grounds and enjoy visiting with the horses kept in a stable near the center of the large residence. In another version, Helen was never Philip's mistress, and by then the mansion had been abandoned. However, the story coincides that her daughter died in a mysterious fire inside the deserted stables. Then, after the death of her daughter, Helen was so distraught that, upon learning of her daughter's death, she gathered a long length of rope and committed suicide by hanging herself from the base of the bridge. Thus, the legend states that on cool, foggy evenings, one can sometimes see Helen's spirit wandering along the winding mountain road near the infamous bridge. Tales of those passing by who have stopped to ask if she were in some kind of trouble are met only with a blank stare from the pensive apparition, along the question, "Have you seen my daughter?" Like many urban legends of this sort, there are even games associated with the famous apparition. Locals in the region will tell you that in order to make Helen's spirit manifest, one need only to park their car directly under the bridge and invoke the spirit by chanting, "Helen, come forth," 3 times. But interestingly, while every town has its variations on such legends, there are also a number of stories shared by credible witnesses that involve the allegedly haunted locale, describing strange, inexplicable occurrences at the lonely bridge. Sometime in the 1970s, a man by the name of Michael lived in the area just beyond the city limits. He claimed that he'd been driving over the mountains on a dark, misty night. The moonlight was bright, almost bright enough to outshine his headlights. He had been driving the narrow, twisting road that led from nearby Tunnel Road over the top of Bowcatcher Mountain. Just as he came around the curve that would set him directly beneath Helen's Bridge, he began to get a strange feeling, but ignored it and continued on his way. Just as he rounded the corner, immediately as he passed under the famous bridge, the lights on his car went dead. He described where he couldn't see a thing. He just steered along in the moonlight, hoping that the headlights would come back on. By the time he had made his way down the opposite side of the mountain and back into town, the headlights did come back on, though now unaffected by the odd influence of whatever had been lingering near the bridge. Even small towns have a haunted house. A long, winding, gray asphalt road splits from a rural highway 30-some miles north of St. Joseph, Missouri, and runs between brown winter farm fields and a scattering of trees before it enters the tiny town of Bulkout, Missouri. A weathered sign welcoming visitors stands at the city limits. To some, the welcome ends there. This hilly town with its curbless streets, long, dark business fronts, and many houses with grand days decades past hides something sinister. Tammin and Tony Morell bought a house there in 2008. They signed the papers on Christmas Eve and moved in Christmas Day. "When we bought the house, it was known as the old haunted house," Tammin said. The house was strange from the first day, partially because the previous owners never really moved. "They left everything," Tony said. "Furniture sat as it had for years. Pictures hung from nails on the walls. Dirty socks lay crumpled in the bathroom closet." "It was spooky," Tammin said. "The table was made. There was food in the refrigerator. Their clothes were in the drawers. They just left." The Morells bought this 2-story, 4-bedroom house after foreclosure. Few prospective buyers had looked at the house, Tammin would find later. "I got it really cheap," Tammin said, "but I didn't expect it to be like this." As Tony, originally from Davenport, Iowa, Tammin from nearby St. Joseph, Missouri, and her children, Catherine and Jake Hatfield, finished carrying boxes into their new home, trickles of strangeness began to fall. The first night I slept on the couch, and I heard pots and pans rattling around, Tammin said. But we hadn't unpacked. We weren't using the kitchen. Tony heard something too, but not pots and pans. It was a voice. It sounded like a kid crying, he said. Last night, I was awakened by my son's voice calling Mom, yet he was sound asleep. The first morning in the house, the smell of breakfast cooking greeted the waking family, but there was no breakfast cooking in the small kitchen. It was weird, Tammin said, but there's always weird smells, like death. The family began to notice the smell of rotting flesh throughout the house, but the smell never lingered. This scent of decay would appear in some parts of the house, then move to others and disappear, only to come back weeks later. The smell continued to plague them, but they never found the cause. During the first month the family lived, their strange occurrences in the house slowly escalated. The smells, children's voices, doors slamming, cabinets opening, and the sound of footsteps were their constant companions. The worst thing about the house, however, was the feeling. A lot of people stay in a room upstairs, they feel it, Tony said. A depressing feeling. Tammin added, if I'm the only person here at night, I feel really depressed, almost frozen, like I can't breathe. The atmosphere on the ground floor of the house is thick, heavy, but Tony said so is the atmosphere of the town. I'm the biggest skeptic in the house, and I've felt things here. Tony said, this house is weird anyway. The whole town is weird. The first month we lived here, we only saw kids, no adults. Yeah, this town is weird. Driving down the road into town, he heard raindrops hit the car, stuck his arm out and felt the cold stinging raindrop hit our hands and arms, smelled the rain. Yet our hands and arms were dry when we pulled it back in the windows. There were no visible raindrops on the car. Yes, this is a weird place. Strange things in the house continued. Thousands of flies appeared in an upstairs room, and the day after the family cleared them out, a thick mass of flies lighted on the porch. A sound like a bowling ball rolling down the upstairs hallway woke Catherine in the night. The dogs refused to go into the basement, and Tammin saw shadow figures wandering through the house. The occurrences became commonplace to the family. Then the house grew violent. I got thrown down the stairs, Tammin said. It was morning time. I was not scared or anything. I was standing on the landing with my dog Chewy, and the next thing I knew I was halfway down the stairs, bouncing down, wondering what happened. They decided to move back to St. Joseph. Although Tammin said the main reason was financial, Tony said another, that it was due to their bizarre life. We didn't like being in this house. The move culminated on All Days on Halloween. It seemed that the previous family had owned the house, was preoccupied with Christmas. Ironically, they moved in on Halloween, which was the day that this other family moved out. Coincidence? The neighbors in Bulkow didn't seem to take kindly to Halloween, and given the fact that the town's population is only 234, everyone is a neighbor. We volunteered to donate Halloween decorations to the park, Tony said. People said, we don't celebrate Halloween. We celebrate the fall harvest. The family decided to celebrate anyway, with a haunted open house. They didn't realize their house was well known outside of Buckle. When we handed out flyers in St. Joseph, Tammin said, this guy said, I know that house. It's in Bulkow. It is evil. The event didn't get any easier. Although many locals shunned the event, some came. When they were drunk, Catherine said, some kids went through, but their parents weren't supposed to know about it. Most of the guests came from out of town to tour Balkow's haunted house, and the house performed. The audio system in the attic behaved of its own free will, an ornament spun from strings in the dead still attic. The activity soon grew intense. There was a girl in my room, and the window imploded, Tammin said. Catherine was there. She stepped back and it blew on her. It was a mistake, I think Tam had said, to do the haunted house. She later on went to describe that upstairs, one time she was sorting clothing in the closet and came out with scratches on her hands and arms. In November, the family moved back to St. Joseph, leaving the strange house behind. They rented the house to Jim, a longtime friend of Tony's, but the house hit the renters with everything it had. They changed so much, Tammin said. They changed when they lived there. Jim, his girlfriend, two teenage boys and a 10-year-old girl moved into the house and immediately felt the weight of the house upon them. The little girl said she came to our house to talk to ghosts, Catherine said. One day the renters were just gone. They left their clothes here, Tammin said. They left their cell phone. There was food in the fridge, Catherine said. And worse, buckets of grease and urine were scattered throughout the house. Tammin and Tony didn't know what had happened to the people who lived in their house, but they knew that the house had done something to them. We didn't know where they were, and they never came back for their stuff. Reluctantly, Tammin and Tony moved their family back into the Bulk Hall house soon after. She went on to describe that the house had not lost its depressing, suffocating, oppressive feeling. It felt like the house sucks every bit of hope and happiness out of a person when they walk through the door. Since we moved back, I have not been able to sleep well, and I can always sleep, Tony said. We all don't, Tammin added. Catherine sat in a kitchen chair holding her hands. I feel like someone is shaking me. They moved back into the hell house, as Tammin calls it, because of personal finances and crime rates in St. Joseph. I thought, let's go back to Balkan, everything will be fine. It wasn't. The haunting continued. Catherine told Tammin of a dream about a little girl who lived in the house. The girl told her, the gray kitty is my favorite. That morning, Tammin found the gray cat had been inexplicably locked in the parlor all night. My life has been nothing but insane since I moved to Balkan, Tony said. Tammin nodded. I feel like I'm in a movie. A horror movie. The Haunted Dorm Room. When I was in college, I went to a university in the Philippines called Ateneo de Manila University. The university was run by Jesuit priests and was fairly new when you compare it to the Ivy League schools in the United States. The land where the university stood was apparently either a prison camp or a war hospital during the Japanese occupation of the Philippines back in World War II. It was summer, and I was dorming in Cervini Hall with three other girls. Michelle, Kat, and a girl who didn't really attend the university, but was just there for summer classes, and therefore I can't remember her name. For the sake of the story, I will call her Summer Girl. Michelle, Kat, and I knew each other pretty well after having lived in the same dorm for the past few terms. We usually lived in Isao Hall, the girls' dorm, during the summer. We had to make do with living in the third floor of the boys' room. This is how we ended up in room 314. From the beginning, there were some strange occurrences in room 314. It wasn't really any big deal in the beginning. It was just things like doors locking by themselves, our hair standing on end in the middle of the night over nothing, stuff like that. But there were two occurrences that really marked our summer experience that year. The first one involved Michelle. Her bed was by the door, and the wall of the door had wooden window jalousies. The jalousies at the bottom half would not close. One night, while Michelle was studying French, she suddenly bolted out of her study desk and ran outside. Kat and I looked at each other in surprise when she did this. Upon her return, we asked her what made her bolt like that. According to Michelle, the reason that she did was that while staring off into space, while studying, she had seen someone through the open jalousies walking very slowly in a long white nightgown. The pace of the person's walk, as well as the what she, Michelle, referred to her as she, was wearing, made her curious, and that was why she ran out. Kat and I asked her then what she found outside. Michelle replied that there was no one outside, but she was sure she had seen that person in a white nightgown walking slowly. She even went next door, she said, because at the rate the person was walking, she would have been next door. but when she opened the door to the next room, no one there was wearing a white nightgown. We never did find out what that thing was, but I remember Kat, Michelle, and I praying that night for the unrestful souls. The second incident in room 314 was even scarier. This time it involved me and Michelle. One night I was experimenting with my new curling iron. I had a mirror positioned on my desk and I was curling my hair. From behind me through the mirror, I could see some of our girls sitting on her chair in front of her desk studying or reading at least. Kat was on her bed next to Summer Girl's bed. Michelle was again across me sitting by her desk studying. As I curled my hair, I could see Summer Girl from her back in my mirror. A few moments on, I thought I heard her crying as well as reading a letter or something like that. The thought, should I approach her and comfort her, crossed my mind, but then I thought, I shouldn't be so nosy after all. I didn't know her that well. So that decided that. I continued curling my hair and eventually got tired of doing so and started to straighten my hair again. She was still crying. As I turned around to talk to Michelle, I suddenly glimpsed Summer Girl sleeping on the bed next to Kat. In the split second that I had seen her through my mirror crying and reading, there was no way that she could have gotten to the bed from the chair that fast. I suddenly realized that the person that I had been seeing in the mirror was not Summer Girl. I glanced at Michelle. She told me. I saw her too. I jumped from my bed, and Michelle and I ended up sleeping in the same bed that night. When Kat saw us lying in the same bed the next day, she asked what happened, and we told her. She said that Summer Girl had gone to sleep the same time as her. I was curling my hair and seeing that girl in the mirror for a good 20 minutes. And all that time, it wasn't her. From that time on, we resolved to pray for the restless souls in our midst before going to bed at night. I think we helped them because we had an uneventful rest of the summer in room 314. A house with a history of evil. This occurred some time ago, but it is still very vivid in my mind of what happened that night. My fiancé, our friend Ed, and I were out joyriding around one night, and it was pretty late. It was probably close to midnight. We were starting to get bored, and my fiancé, James, spoke up and said, "Well, what do you guys want to do?" I couldn't think of anything, and quite frankly, I was getting a little tired, and I wanted to go home. Our friend Ed said, "Why don't we go to that house off Highway 36? I said, "What house?" And James said, "You'll see." So he started driving in that direction, and we came to this huge, run-down, two-story house. Immediately, I felt uneasy and nauseous. The house had no paint on it. The doors were gone and the windows were all busted out. There was a falling-in barn on the far right of the house near the backyard, and in the front yard there were a few trees, but one in particular was very big. In the backyard, from what I could see, there was just an old cellar. Also in the front yard, there was what looked like to be a falling-in well. I asked James what the story was on this house. He said that back in the 1900s, there was a family that lived here, a husband and wife and their children. I can't remember how many children. I said, "Okay, so why did you guys bring me out here?" And he said that when they lived here, somehow mercury got into the well water and caused the entire family to go insane. The man killed all of his children with an axe, hung his wife in the front yard on the really big tree I mentioned earlier, and then shot himself in the front yard afterwards. Now, I do know that you can find this article in the newspaper in the library of my town, so I know that there is truth to this. I said, "Okay." I didn't really know what to expect at this point, and then our truck died. Well, that didn't really scare me because vehicles do that sometimes when they sit and idle for a few minutes. I was looking around and my eyes came to the side of the house near the backyard, and I will swear to this. I saw a huge dog. I know it was a dog because I could see the glint of reflected light on his eyes when he would turn his head, and I could see his pink tongue moving in and out of his mouth as he panted. I could also see his rib cage as he was breathing. This dog was no ordinary dog. It was gigantic. I can't think of any breed of dog or animal that could be that big. I just stared and pointed. I was utterly speechless. The guys looked at each other and looked at me, and then the truck died again and would not start. Then from the corner of my eye, I saw movement. The guy saw it too because they turned their heads to look in the same direction I was looking in. There was someone walking through the house. And the weird part was that 1 minute this thing would be upstairs where you could see it in the window, and the next minute it would be downstairs in the window. I was very frightened at this point. I started feeling as if I couldn't breathe. It was like pressure on my chest. I looked around the yard and thought I saw someone walking around. The guy saw it too, but this was not a regular person. I do not think it was as if one moment it was a full figure and the next moment you could almost see through whatever it was. James was trying to start the truck and it finally did. We pulled out of the driveway and started for home. They won't admit it, but they were just as scared as I was. When we got home, I started some bath water. I looked in the mirror and saw something on my chest. There was a massive handprint. I called James in to look at it, and he said that he saw it too. I think that while we were at the house, something was pushing on my chest. That's why I couldn't breathe. I did see other things at that house that night, but I do not know how to explain them. I do know one thing, though, that whatever walks in that house does not walk alone.